Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Global warming. It's a big issue today, and there's been much concern over what to do about it. But as you'll learn in today's program, global warming has happened before, fairly recently in mankind's history. How did this earlier global warming affect the people of the time? Who were the losers and who were the winners? And what can we learn from their experience that could help us cope with the environmental challenges that lie ahead? For the answers, please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts, The Great Warming. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In today's program, we're going to examine the history of climate change. And to help us understand this important subject, we're very fortunate to have with us Professor Brian Fagan, author of The Great Warming, Climate Change, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Professor Fagan received a PhD in anthropology and archaeology from Cambridge in 1964. He was professor of anthropology at the University of California at Santa Barbara for 36 years, retiring in 2003 to devote full time to writing. In recent years, Professor Fagan has authored several books focusing on the history of climate change, including The Little Ice Age, published in 2002, and The Great Warming, which we're discussing today. Professor Fagan, thanks very much for joining us today on History Counts.
My pleasure.
The last ice age ended over 12,000 years ago. Has the world's climate been unchanged since that time?
The world's climate is always changing. It's never constant. If you think of a zigzag line, that's accurate. The general trend for the last 12,000 years has been toward warming. In fact, the last 10,000 years have been some of the most stable years climatically since the last 400,000 years. So we are in a sustained period of fairly warm climate. If you look at the long canvas of the Ice Age, you would call an interglacial. And these interglacial periods typically are ended by cooler climatic episodes, and when the next one will come is a matter of debate.
So the changes that you chronicle in your book are small changes relative to an ice age.
Oh, yes. You're talking here about a revolution in climatology during the last 25 or 30 years, which is now enabling us to look at ancient climate in a very much more fine-grained way. And what we're discovering is that many minor climatic fluctuations kind of rippled through history, and while they didn't necessarily topple civilizations, they certainly had effects on the way people exploited their environments and reacted to climate change.
Where does one look for evidence of these past climate changes?
One source is deep core drills into the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets. In the Antarctica, they've gone back over 400,000 years into the Ice Age. In Greenland, they've gone back well over 100,000. So that's one source. Another source are deep sea cores bored into the sediment at the bottom of the oceans. The best known ones of those are one in the Southwest Pacific, and one also in the Cariaco Basin in Venezuela, or Venezuela, which has given us quite a lot of information on drought at the time of the Maya civilization. Then you have probably one of the most important of all for more recent history, which is dendrochronology, which is tree ring chronology. Chronology is put together by studying the growth rings of trees, which vary with temperature and rainfall and so on. And this is an extensive study in Europe and in North America and all over the place. So you've got a variety of sources. And when I tell you that dendrochronology is so accurate now that they can actually date the date of manufacture of a Stradivarius violin and tell that two of them were made from the same piece of wood, you'll understand it's pretty accurate stuff. Now, all these climate change things, with possibly the exception of tree rings, are what are called proxies. They're indirect indications of climate change, and we have to kind of extrapolate that against what we know from archaeology. Of course, tree rings, you're looking at beams of southwestern and pueblos and so on, and the dating of actual artifacts or church spires. So really, that is much more direct.
Well, when did the Great Warming occur, and what was its impact, for example, on Europe?
The Great Warming is, in fact, the name for a period of what appears to have been at times fairly sustained warming between about AD 800 to about 1200, 1250. This period was first identified by a British meteorological historian in the 1950s and 60s, and until recently was fairly poorly defined. And as this gentleman, Hubert Lamb, pointed out many years ago, it seems to have manifested itself in Europe with fairly prolonged periods of years when there were very nice, somewhat drier, warmer conditions in late summer in Europe, which resulted in excellent harvests. And temperatures rose sufficiently that you could grow wine in England and northern Germany. So there was a significant warming. The same warming produced warm enough conditions to grow cereal crops in Scandinavia and even in Iceland. And from the European point of view, this sounds good, but of course, life for a medieval peasant, and everyone in Europe at that point pretty well lived at the subsistence level, was pretty harsh. Life expectancy was about 28, and really, you lived from one harvest to the next. The people who really benefited from this, of all people, were the Norse, commonly called the Vikings, because ice conditions in the North Atlantic improved significantly, and the southernmost frontier of the pack ice in the North Atlantic retreated way north of Iceland, with the result that it was easier to voyage west from the Faroe Islands to Iceland, and then, of course, the exiling of Eric the Red, who went to Greenland and came back and then colonized it, and, of course, the famous journey of Leif Erikson and others to North America and the colonization of Greenland. So you've got a period of favorable climate.
How did the warming period in Europe relate to the flowering of the High Middle Ages?
It seems to have coincided in broad terms with it. During the medieval warm, there was significant population growth. A great deal more land was taken up into cultivation. There was extensive forest clearance, much of it at the hands of new monastic communities. Cities grew, trade began to expand significantly, and of course it was the period with the beginning of the building of Gothic cathedrals. So it was a significant period of expansion.
In terms of new towns, I was surprised to see in your book the statistic that there were 1,500 new towns in Central Europe between the 11th century to the mid-12th century. Quite an astounding development.
What it really is a reflection of growing population. The landscape was getting more crowded, and of course increased interaction and trade.
Well, now you're right that 985 AD, Eric the Red founded these colonies in Greenland. What was Greenland like then compared to now?
Greenland then was somewhat warmer in the summers. The summers were probably longer, and the growing season for hay, for graze, for cattle, must have been significantly longer, maybe a month longer. And that in that environment, where for much of the year you were feeding cattle inside, was very significant. And at the same time, ice conditions were better. And we also suspect that temperatures in the ocean, in the Davis Strait, were warmer. And this is something which may have encouraged cod to migrate northward, because cod livers are very sensitive to water temperature and they don't like extreme cold. And it may be that the cod fisheries were very important to the Norse.
And by 1000, Leif Erikson, Eric's son, was in Newfoundland. So this was expansion at a pretty rapid pace.
It was. The thing about the Norse is that they were extremely expert sailors. And they apparently were people with wanderlust and insatiable curiosity. But one of the things that drove people to explore further west than Greenland was firstly the knowledge that there was land over there. You don't have to go far out in the Davis Strait to see Baffin Land. And secondly, the obligation to hunt walrus, because walrus ivory was the way that the Norse colony paid its tithe to the church back in Norway. At the same time, they lived in a treeless environment. And once they found Labrador and they coasted down the coast using the favorable Baffin Island current, and they found timber, it was an obvious place to acquire wood to build new ships, because the life of a Norse knarr or merchantman was probably 10 or 15 years. So they constantly had a need to build new ships.
And you also write that the discoveries of the Norse initiated a complex trade in ivory and iron. Could you talk about that?
With the Inuit, yes, it did. There's increasing evidence from archaeological sites in Baffin Land and elsewhere that there was contact between the Inuit and the Norse. How sustained these contacts were, how regular they are, we won't ever know. But the presence of iron objects, even bits of Norse chainmail, in some sites of the day suggests that there was quite regular trade, on the one hand in ivory and the other hand in nails and other pieces of what to the Norse would have been junk iron. So yes, it's very well documented at this point.
Well, now, moving on from Europe, you write, quote, "What was for Europe and the Arctic a time of relative climatic benevolence was for vast areas of the American West a time of deprivation and suffering. As an example, could you please discuss the effect of the great warming on the people of Chaco Canyon in New Mexico?"
There were severe droughts, which are well documented in Sierra Lakes and also in the Southwest, which, of course, is the great laboratory of tree ring research. And one of the places where the tree ring research has been extremely intense is Chaco Canyon, which is known as the Stonehenge of America. Around the 10th century A.D., the ancestral Pueblo built a series of large, semicircular, multi-story pueblos there, which archaeologists often call great houses. And then, around 1140, these houses were abandoned. And one of the big debates among experts is why they were abandoned. And if you look very closely at the tree ring records, you can see that there were droughts, severe 50-year droughts at about this time. And this great drought may well have caused people to move, because the traditional response of Pueblo Indians to drought, to dry conditions, and it's in their oral traditions, is simply to move elsewhere where there was more water. And for that reason, they maintain kin ties with people living long distances away, so that if there is a drought, they can move. There's a lot of difference between a drought, which lasts a year, 2 years, 3 years, and a prolonged drought. The droughts of the medieval warm lasted in parts of the West 200 years, and the ones in Chaco at least 50. So you're talking about people who were very expert at unpredictable rainfall, who knew that their real enemy was prolonged drought. And there was nothing these people didn't know about managing water in semi-arid environments. And indeed, if you look at, say, the Near East or Africa or even Islamic Spain, these people were maestros of teasing water out of seemingly dry environments. They really were good at it in ways that were not.
Well, the Great Warming also came at the height of the Mayan civilization of Central America. What effect did it have on the Mayans?
There was a big collapse in the 10th century of much of Maya civilization, which has caused probably more scholarly debate than almost any subject in archaeology. And it's only in recent years that we've really begun to study ancient Maya agriculture. And they were farming in an environment of moderately fertile soils, in an environment of very unpredictable rainfall. And they, as their population grew, exploited every environmental niche you can imagine, with great success. But what has also become apparent is that they were brilliant water managers. They had to be. They couldn't really irrigate because they didn't have the large floodplains, the annual floods, like you find, say, on the Nile. So what they did was rely very heavily on cisterns and reservoirs, and the great pyramids of their centers were actually water catchment towers as well, and water flowed down them in rainstorms and was collected in reservoirs and then carefully parceled out to surrounding fields. And there's a huge volume of elaborate water rituals surrounding the Maya lords, which really played a role in all this. And the Maya lords said that they were the providers of the water. And when prolonged droughts, and again the word prolonged came, which we've identified in deep sea cores and in freshwater lake cores, and then after 3 or 4 years when the reservoirs began to run dry, people said to them, where's the rain, where's the water? Their authority was seriously undermined, and this may have contributed to the Maya collapse.
You suggest that the great cities such as Tikal and Copan fell apart as a social disorder erupted, perhaps due to hunger and water shortages.
Yes. Another cause, I think, was the environmental degradation, just over-cultivation of soil, and clearance deforestation was a serious problem with all the erosion that means. And also the elite, who were growing in numbers rapidly, were placing increasing demands on the people. And you put all that together, you've got a pretty volatile formula.
Now, could you talk about the connection between the Great Warming and warfare? Particularly, how did it relate to the savage conquests of the Mongols under Genghis Khan in the early 13th century?
What you've got to do is think of somewhere like the northern steppes or the Sahara as a huge set of lungs. When the climate is slightly wetter, and believe it or not, 1 or 2 inches of rain a year can make a significant difference. There is standing water over much of the steppe, and both animals and humans tend to be sucked in by the lungs and to inhabit the steppe. But if it dries up, it pushes them out like a pair of lungs to the margins. And it looks possible that there is a connection with the great expansion of Genghis Khan with drought in the medieval warm, which pushed people out to the edges, because there's an ineluctable fact about cattle, and that is that they must have water every 24 hours, and you also have to water horses regularly. And there is a classic conflict in early civilization between people living on settled lands and those living as nomads, and this is kind of part of what played in, apart from his charismatic leadership and all the other things we know about. But there's no question, and this is something that really has not yet been studied in detail, that there is some connection between drought and people moving out of the steppe. In fact, soon after the death of Genghis Khan, there was a period when the steppe was better watered and many of the conquests slowed.
Because of the improved pasturage where they came from. Do we know what caused the Great Warming?
No, no one knows. It may be connected with tilts in the Earth's axis, but nobody really knows.
Well, turning to more recent climate conditions, you write, quote, we've entered a time of sustained warming, which dates back to at least 1860, propelled in large part by human activity, by the greenhouse gases from fossil fuels. Well, are the consequences of the current climate trends potentially as severe as those you discussed in the Great Warming?
They scare me. Disregard for a moment the debate on whether humans are causing global warming or not. That debate is tired, and I am very sick of it. But what nobody can deny is that currently, and for a while, we've been living in a warming world. 1,000 years ago, temperatures rose modestly, like they are now. The result was very widespread drought, especially in arid and semi-arid lands.
How many degrees temperature are we talking about in the Great Warming?
About 3.5 degrees, something like that, 4 degrees, maybe a little more. A relatively small amount, but if you go back and look at Sierra Lakes 1,000 years ago, here were 200-year droughts. Now, if you come forward to today, and we are seeing droughts already in the West, partly El Niños, which of course bring rain here, you're looking at a situation where the population is immeasurably higher than ever before, where we have the technology to pump aquifers deep below the earth, which are finite sources of water, We have huge cities like LA and Tucson and Phoenix drawing water from hundreds of miles away and from the aquifers. And we are not living in a self-sustaining mode as far as water supplies are concerned. Now, add to this, in the future, a prolonged drought and some very respectable institutions with very sophisticated computer models are projecting that the proportion of the world to be exposed to extreme drought conditions will jump massively in the next 50 years, not the next 150, the next 50. We are in trouble.
So you see drought as the principal threat brought by this climate change?
In my judgment, at this point, yes. Because it's a shorter-term problem than many of the others. Sure, rising temperatures are difficult. Sure, so is melting ice. So is rising sea levels. Those are the sexy things. Drought is the unsexy one we live with every day. And yet most people's consciousness of the severity of the drought situation is zero. And this is really scary.
Are the effects of this climate change liable to vary according to the location, as with the great warming?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, the areas that are really potentially affected are the American West, parts of the Pacific, North China, India, Australia and New Zealand, especially Australia, Northeast Brazil, the Saharan Sahel, Ethiopia, much of sub-Saharan Africa, and parts of Europe will have serious water shortages within 10 years, and Spain is in trouble already. So you're looking at very, very tricky, challenging period ahead because we have very few options.
In terms of the rapidity with which climate change occur, there's a precedent which is, you mentioned, the younger Dryas period. It was about 9,000 BC, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that occurred very rapidly. Could you briefly describe that? And is there a possibility that such a disaster could occur in the near future?
Most people believe that this was a 1,000-year cold period that was triggered by melting of ice that once covered Canada that just dispatched billions of liters of fresh water into the North Atlantic, basically shutting down the Gulf Stream extremely rapidly because it sealed off the circulation of the heavier salt seawater. Now, whether or not this could happen again is a question that's been debated. What, for example, would happen if the Greenland ice sheet suddenly imploded and all that water went into the North Atlantic? Theoretically, in any way, much of the North could be cascaded into a rapid ice age-like condition for 1,000 years. There were those who were studying this who believe it's a possible scenario. Other people say that the Younger Dryas was a special, unique case.
It also has to do with the delicate relationship between water currents and water temperature and salinity.
There are lots of different variables in a still very little understood equation. You have to realize that a huge amount of oceanography and particularly paleoclimatology is still real frontier science. We are light years away from where we were 10 years ago, and in another 10 years, it's really going to be different again.
Well, the story of the great warming is largely a story of attempts to adapt to climate change.
Correct.
What sort of adaptations might people, for example, in the United States have to make during this century?
Well, there are all sorts of things. One thing people say is we're going to get many more extreme climatic conditions, hurricanes, severe El Niños, and so on. That immediately challenges places at low levels. Miami, New Orleans, we've already seen Katrina, L.A., and so on. And the people that will hit the hardest are the poor. If, on the other hand, the other big danger is drought or excessive flooding. Drought is, to my mind, the big one, and that's very difficult because water is finite. There are limits to the amount politically, socially, economically that we can transport water over distance. Desalinization is hideously expensive and also has ecological consequences, and then you get into the use of fossil fuels. The only option you have is nuclear. Are we going to go nuclear? No. Why? Because public opinion is against it.
We can't move Los Angeles like Chaco Canyon was moved.
No, you can't. Because the other point about this is now we're dealing not with 2,000 people, you're dealing with millions. And we're dealing with intricate infrastructures. It is said by experts that if we really take water conservation seriously as a national goal, we'll be fine. The problem is to convince people to do this when it's a problem that will really confront our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And you know politicians. They live from one election to the next. This is a terribly serious problem. And generally, public awareness of water conservation and the strategies you can do to do it are zero, especially in a society where a great deal of emphasis is placed on individual possessions, quote-unquote, what's in it for me, and personal advantage. So there's a great deal of altruism needed here. This is a very scary situation, which is creeping up on us with considerable rapidity.
Well, based on past human experiences, are you optimistic about humanity's ability to successfully adapt to the current climate change?
Yes, I am very optimistic. We've been on this earth as modern humans, as Homo sapiens. And remember, we are the wise people. We are able to innovate, to think ahead, and to plan for all our bizarre behavior. And there were those who argue that it's out of line to talk about doomsday scenarios with, say, drought or rising sea levels, that we have the technology to cope. That isn't the point. The point is that the real thing that's going to save us and enable us to adapt, and the price is going to be high. A lot of people are probably going to be thirsty. A lot of people are going to die. But in the long run, what will save us is a combination of our technology and of our ingenuity, because there are solutions, and these solutions probably revolve around conservation, architectural innovation, and so on. But to make the changes in a society that stresses expansion and consumption is extraordinarily hard.
Well, Professor Fagan, thanks very much for being with us today. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been speaking about the history of climate change with Professor Brian Fagan, author of The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Professor Fagan's website is brianfagan.com. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. Although the Great Warming was generally a benefit to Europe, its close at the end of the 13th century brought an era of climate disaster. In the early 14th century, Europe was hammered by years of heavy rains, which destroyed crops and led to a famine that killed an estimated 1.5 million people. And some believe that this famine, by weakening the population, contributed significantly to Europe's devastation during the Black Plague. The story of the Great Warming of the Middle Ages and its aftermath is an important reminder of how mankind is now, and always has been, extremely vulnerable to changes in climate, and that while climate change can bring benefit to some, it can bring disaster to others. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs, see a schedule of upcoming shows, and sign up for our monthly newsletter and podcasts. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.